Good afternoon. Are you guys awake? Good afternoon. All right, thank you. Okay, good. I'm glad you're all awake. Well, thank you all for coming. Like Wendy said, it's a beautiful day out there, especially for those of you who came from the East Coast or the Midwest, where back in Chicago it's snowing or has snowflakes or flurries. So anyway, thanks for coming. This has been a nice collection of presentations, and we've gone from entire countries to regions, and I'm going to get small. So I'm going to be talking about some work we've done in rural Kenya. Also, to just kind of give you a little background and context, this project is not a federally funded large Research One University project. It really started from a conversation with young people in a rural community of Kenya who wanted to see if we could help them out. And this is what came from that. So it's practice first, then turned into research, and we've kind of melded practice and research. And like Wendy talked about earlier, I think the importance of policy, you know, we're trying to move toward that as well. So I just want to acknowledge that. Here's our co-authors on this project, most of whom either were or are graduate students, except for Lexa Murphy. So this is really kind of a grassroots project that we've been doing in Kenya. And I don't have any relationships to disclose. All right, so one thing that's one of my pet peeves and is that people always talk about Africa as a country, not really as a continent. So just to give you a little context, there's Kenya over there, a little part of a huge continent. There's Kenya. We just heard about a project in Western Kenya. We've been working more in Central Kenya and in a rural area. And one thing that I wanted to just share is a Kenyan proverb. The other thing that bothers me is African proverbs, like the whole continent has a proverb that they all share. So this is a Kenyan proverb I got from a friend in Kenya, that having a good discussion is like having riches. And I think one thing that I really learned from working in Kenya and spending time in Kenya, not just working there, but living with people and sharing with people, is the importance of stories, the importance of narratives, the importance of just sharing your life with each other. And really that's what I want to do today. So a little bit about HIV in Kenya. As we all know, it's been one of the most critically impacted African countries. Approximately 1.1 million people in Kenya are believed to be living with HIV, although it's hard to get good seroprevalence data in a lot of areas. And really, only about 14% of Kenyan adults are aware of their status. One thing we've been finding, too, is that a lot of adolescents don't get tested for HIV because there's not youth-friendly testing services. So actually, we've been working in the rural area to try and develop some of those efforts. But so we have very little data on actually adolescent HIV rates. So national trends, we saw there was a peak around 2003 with about 120,000 deaths, and there has been some decrease in the rates. And the majority of new infections are still occurring among youth and young adults, especially young women between 15 and 24 and young men under the age of 30. So I think that shows the importance of working with youth. Also, rural youth. There's been a lot of work done that's shown that we need to be focusing more efforts on rural youth. It makes it very complicated because the region we work in is very difficult just to get to, much less bring supplies and resources. But about 81% of Kenyans live in rural areas. So if we're talking about a country where the vast majority of people are rural, we need to focus on those areas. Also, we see lower levels of knowledge in the rural areas because a lot of the information doesn't get there. And also, they're more likely to engage in different sexual behaviors, putting them at risk for HIV. There was this one study I saw, the only one I could find, that directly compared urban and rural youth in Kenya and did find that earlier sexual debut, lower rates of condom use, and less accurate HIV transmission knowledge. So I think it really shows a great need for that. And I think in order to design culturally appropriate HIV prevention programs, that we really need to understand the culture and the context. Just like the audience member talked about, culture and context are extremely important to understanding. So really what we wanted to do here is to look at the range of multi-systemic factors that influence HIV-related sexual risk and protective factors. So we look both at risk and resiliency among rural youth. So just to show you some pictures, this is a town called Thigio. It's in Limuru in central Kenya. It's probably about 45 minutes outside of Nairobi. So just to kind of give you a visual context, a very beautiful place. It's been an amazing opportunity to work there and for the people in the community to really invite us in. So I'm going to be presenting some data based on focus groups. So this total of 9 focus groups with 199 youth. Should have gotten one more to have that 200, but, you know. Got to go with what you got. So our youth were between 14 and 24, 55%, female, 45% male. And the group that we've been working with is the Kikuyu, which is the largest ethnic group. There's 42 ethnic groups within Kenya. About 22% are Kikuyu. They also constitute, or if you're aware of the political unrest that's gone on there, the Kikuyu played a large role in there and with other efforts too. We recruited youth through existing youth groups and then also informational flyers in the community. All were conducted in English. In this region, in the area where we work, the youth like to speak English because it's kind of cool to speak English. And so we did talk to them about should we try and do it in either Kikuyu or in Kiswahili. And like, no, we want to speak English. So that's how what we went with. And they were all recorded and transcribed verbatim. So a little bit about our procedure and analysis. So we asked them to describe multiple systemic influences on both sexual risk and protection. Also, we wanted their ideas for HIV prevention. What do you want to do? What do you need? What would you like some help with? Start with more grand tour questions and then ask specific probes or ask probes as appropriate to gather more detailed and nuanced data. We had a team of analysts who were all people who had worked in Kenya with youth to look at this, and we used a more phenomenological approach. So we really wanted to understand the lives and experiences of these youth to look at how we can develop interventions. Instead of coming in with our Western framework, we wanted to learn from them and their stories and to have a more culturally and contextually grounded approach to the analysis instead of having our Western lens put onto their life experiences. So just some pictures of the youth. One thing that we did is we did some workshops with them after some of the focus groups doing capacity building and action planning. A big focus of our work is not making the youth dependent on us to do for them, but to give them the skills so they can do for themselves. So this was an activity after some of the focus groups of doing community action planning, where they developed action plans for how to make changes within their community, and then we helped to provide them with resources and strategies to bring about changes in their own community. So, and this is actually, this group here I wanted to show last, this is the youth center, which is really kind of a little an abandoned shed that was turned into a youth center. And a lot of these young folks here were some of the young folks who, on my very first trip to Thigio back in December of 2004, I just started hanging out with them in the youth center, and we just started talking, and they said, "Can you help us out? Can you do something?" And so a lot of these young people are ones who really started this whole initiative. The young man in the hat, there's a young man named James who has been working with us ever since that point, and he actually organized an HIV testing day in that community. And so it's been really exciting to see their capacity being built and them being able to do things for the community instead of us having to come in and do it. So some of the results. That's why you're all here, right? So I'm going to break this up into looking at this in multiple ecological levels and multiple systems. So at the individual level, still a lot of inaccurate knowledge, lack of education about that, and then some quotes in red, teach them what condoms are, how to use them, because they get distorted messages about condoms. Substance use. There's a lot of substance use in this area. Wendy was talking about the substance use in South Africa. Very easy accessibility of alcohol or chenga, and a lot of it is home brews, which are very deadly. And so we've seen several episodes where there's been home brews that have been tainted, and you know, you'll see 40, one time we were there, like 42 men died within a period of a week because of the toxicity. And then marijuana or bong. Just a little side story. Audrey Bengi is one of the people who have worked with us on this project, and they still get a big kick out of her last name being Bengi and Bongi being marijuana. So every time the kids, you know, they get a big laugh at that. It's like, "Hey, do you know what your name means?" It's like, "Yes." So by that, you lose control because you're gaining access to drugs, some drugs which are even stimulating sexually, is one of the quotes from the participants. And then this is something interesting, access to pornography. And this is also tied in with some of the Western influences. There's been a big influx of pornography. And pornography is defined differentially in the community. So in some instances, it's really more kind of sexually provocative ads and things like that. But there is this, has been this influx of more sexually provocative material, both in print media. There's not much access to computer, but there is some. And so some of it's through the internet as well. But a lot of the youth, this is something that kept coming up over and over again as a factor that they thought influenced it. Moving up to a more dyadic level, an interactional level, looking at friends and family, peer pressure is both negative and positive. So with negative peer pressure, there's a lot of peer pressure to play sex. It's a term that's often used for having sex, also to use alcohols. And for males, there's this real pressure to adhere to a masculine ideal. So you're not a real man until you've impregnated a woman. So for here, the pressure from the friends say you're not a man. You're not a real man if you cannot breed. You see the pressure he will give into it, because now you go and approach your girlfriend and you find yourself doing it because of the pressure of the friends. There's also positive peer pressure, though, again, since we were looking at both a risk and resistance or risk and resiliency framework. So if you have accurate information, you can give it to other people, and then you can behave nice, then others will look up to you, and you can also get the message to continue the trend. And there's a lot of desire to be activists in people's community, a lot more sense of connection, which was really exciting, and we've really been trying to expand that. And then a lack of parent-child communication, and a lot of what we've ended up doing is doing a lot of workshops with parents, because the youth are telling us, you know, my parents don't know any of this. You need to be educating them and working with them. Looking at sexual and romantic dyads. So one is older partners and survival sex. I put those together because there's a fine line between kind of the reasons why young people talk about dating an older partner and then also having transactional sex. And so it's not always a clear-cut distinction. It's usually talked about with young women dating older men, many of whom are positive. But you do see, we've seen a lot of young men talk about exchanging, having sex in exchange for goods as well, much more than I've seen some of my domestic work here in the U.S. So I'd like to emphasize, this is a young woman in one of the groups, to emphasize what the lady said about someone sleeping with a man just to get by. A lot of the youths around here are in poverty, and most of the older men there, in fact. So it comes back to what, again, the audience member said about poverty is a pervasive issue here. Also, this is something that's been interesting, too, that we saw, and I think this is somewhat related to the Westernization and Western influences. There's a lot of socioeconomic status imbalances, and that can lead to exchange sex for money as well. So because of the need to be equal with someone who is well up, you will be tempted to take money from a guy who is ready to offer the money in exchange for sex. So it's not always just survival. It's about the pressure of being an adolescent and wanting to be like those others who are higher up than you are. And then still a lot of interpersonal and dating violence, high rates of rape, including political and systematic rape. So during the political unrest, there were some politically motivated systematic raping of individuals. We do work with the Nairobi Women and Children's Hospital, and they saw a huge influx in rapes post the violence. Some cultural factors. We looked at these both as health promoting and then also potentially health, damaging in some respects. Health promoting influences of both traditional Kikuyu, and they will talk about both Kikuyu culture and then kind of broader kind of Pan-African cultural values, which promote self-respect, respect for elders, abstaining from sex and virginity. Just a quote, 20 years ago as a country we looked at our African culture and traditions and that we should miss today because we lose so much of the African values which we respected our age groups or we respected ourselves. Like nowadays we have fallen and it's hardly okay to be a virgin. And that was from a young man. Health compromising traditional, and again, it seems like I had a plant in the audience with the gentleman's comments he just made. So issues like wife inheritance, arranged marriages, polygamy, and then sex after circumcision with some of the different ethnic groups after you get circumcised as a young man around 13, 14, 15, to get the scabs off, you go have sex. And so then that presents a huge risk of transmission. So here's just another quote. You find that a young girl is forced in a marriage by parents to an old person, to an old man, maybe even to be a fifth wife. The husband has to sleep with the girl before she goes to the husband's house. If the man is infected, you see he's already infected the girl, a very young girl. And then some health-compromising cultural myths still related to HIV cures. I know this is pervasive in other parts of sub-Saharan Africa as well, the belief that if you have sex with a virgin, you'll be cured from HIV. So a man is thinking that having sex with a virgin will take away the virus in him, but once you get the knowledge, you know that that will not happen. Also around cultural factors, the influence of Western culture has changed traditional African culture and affected sexual behavior. We are so much on Western values, that's why they are copying what's on TV. We should go back to our African values. Sex is more for marriage, for married people. That's what I'm saying. That is what types of values, African values. It's very interesting, the influence of Western culture and media. You know, the most popular U.S. folks over there, besides Barack Obama, of course, which everyone is Barack Obama's cousin. And especially when they find out we're from Chicago, you know, he's like, oh yeah, go talk to Barack and see if you really are. But it's Tyra Banks and Oprah Winfrey. That's who they see as the U.S. because that's the media images that they're seeing. Also, we're seeing the influx of different types of music, like rap music and hip-hop, some of which they're taking some of the negative values. Like, for instance, I had a young man come to a workshop with jeans that had guns all over them. And we talked and spent a lot of time kind of thinking about and talking about what does that mean? What does that mean that you have those? Because they're not, it's becoming so much a part of what young people are doing that they're not really thinking through these issues. And I should speed up because it's getting late. Religious values, some health-promoting influences of Christianity and Catholicism. So again, both the positive and the negative. Some support sexual responsibility, self-respect, and spiritual guidance. And so here's a quote about need for churches to be involved in youth and help them with leading a more spiritual life. But then also health compromising. The Catholic Church, you know, does not support condom use. Other religious groups do not support condom use. And here's an example of an erroneous belief I thought was more powerful. So I think that we should discourage them talking about condoms and tell them that the condom allows the virus to enter in them, through them. So they have tiny holes called micros. So they go, even according to my view, the condom do not prevent the entry of the virus. And some of these messages they feel are being perpetuated by some religious leaders as well. At a societal level, gender equality is a huge issue. And again, Wendy's talked about that in terms of the women in South Africa. And we see this, I think, a lot of places. A lot of this discussion in the focus groups was more focused on female youth. I think the female gender should be educated on their rights. This is a young woman. Yes, like when to say no, even when he's your husband. Then HIV and STI stigma. So there's general stigma around HIV, but other also sexually transmitted infections. But a lot of concerns around people finding out that you have an STI or HIV so you don't get tested. Again, because there's such a close-knit community, particularly in the rural areas, if you go someplace and get tested, then your auntie may be there or your neighbor may be there and someone's going to find out. And even hear the belief that the doctors don't keep the information confidential. And then the absence of positive role models, and this is both for males and females. A lot of them talked about feeling that there's people out there who aren't kind of living what they say. So I think also lack of role models. Let's say like older people, let's say they preach with water and take wine, meaning that maybe they say that, you shall not be promiscuous, and then they are the first ones to run those people to the barmaids. Then more environmental or structural level issues. Lack of jobs, unemployment, lack of jobs. They talked about leads to a lot of risky behavior. There just aren't job opportunities in a lot of rural communities. They're losing some of the ability to farm, and some of the values are not being passed down in terms of agrarian societies and cultures because the youth are wanting to go to the big city. They want to go to Nairobi. Poverty, again, I mean, poverty comes up multiple times. This is a young man saying, I want to talk about poverty. The youth are a bit poor in our society, and the rates of HIV will not go down because most of the young people, they have to participate in projects so they can get money. And by projects, he was talking about having sex with people for money. Idleness. This came up over and over and over again. This is kind of the one of the key terms that people just kept talking about, is that the youth are idle. They're bored. There's nothing to do. There's so much free time. And I think that this, they have talked about attributes to then engaging in both substance use and sexual risk behavior. So I think curiosity is being brought by idleness. So if you could engage the youth in activities to stop them being idle, the decision to have sex would be stopped. So some of their HIV prevention ideas, I'll go through these kind of quickly. They want groups and workshops. They love the workshops. They want them to be youth designed and youth led. They want participation and discussion, dramas and skits, accurate condom knowledge and skills, videos, and then also visits from youth and adults living with HIV. They want job skills training. They see that job skills training may be one of the best ways to do HIV prevention. If people have jobs and they have income, they're not having to use their bodies. HIV-related stigma reduction campaigns, also condom distribution, social and athletic clubs. Again, this goes back to the whole idleness issue, and this is something actually we've been doing work with of starting football or soccer clubs and other types of activities. And then community-wide demonstrations and marches. A lot of the young people are very activist-oriented and talked about doing a march within the community to try and open people's eyes, and again, more youth-led activities. So just some quick things to wrap up. Youth identified a range of both risk and protective factors. And like I said, some serve as both risk and protection, so it's not always an easy thing to look at. So peers can be facilitative in terms of facilitating protective behaviors, but also risk, and also culture can be looked at in different ways as well. Also, gender difference existed, some with regard to risk and protective. I didn't go into great depth in that. But that poverty appears to diminish some of the gender differences, and we especially saw this in transactional sex. A lot of the young men talk about having transactional or survival sex in the face of poverty. I think we need to go beyond basic prevention education and look at this at multiple levels. And also we need to include youth in all the stages of development and implementation and look at culturally appropriate delivery models. And also we need to build the capacity of local communities and focus on sustainable change instead of making a lot of these, especially rural communities, dependent on outsiders. So just to kind of finish up, the multi-systemic levels that we saw in our data was the individual level. We need to work on issues of education, substance use, self-control. Dyadic level interventions could be implemented, working with families, friends, romantic partners, sexual partners. We could do cultural level interventions, looking at traditional beliefs, Western beliefs and cultures and religion. Then also societal level interventions, attacking issues of gender inequality, stigma, and role models. And then larger level environmental and structural level factors, working on issues of employment, poverty, and idleness. So thank you very much for listening, and if anyone has any questions. You're all totally exhausted, right? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, well, I think that, that's not an easy answer. But no, I totally agree with you. I mean, I think that we need to do more participatory, collaborative work with communities instead of on communities. I think that we also need to, although I think there's such this urgency around HIV that sometimes we feel like we have to just jump in and do, but we can do more damage. And I think that we have to sometimes be comfortable with doing that ethnographic work and really working with that, you know, around the whole circumcision issue in Kenya. You know, you've got different, with 42 different ethnic groups, they all have different beliefs and rituals around circumcision. And so if you're going to come in without a context and understanding of what the Luo in Western Kenya think about circumcision, it's not going to work. And they may tell you to your face, oh yeah, sure, we would love to do that campaign. But if you don't know the way that circumcision, that's not promoted by that ethnic group, then you're wasting a lot of time and a lot of money. And I think that we have to find ways to not just keep putting, you know, kind of the tourniquet on the bleeding arm, and we need to really look at how do we address this in a long-term manner and do it in a way that's sustainable and culturally appropriate, and that people in the areas we're working with can take ownership for it. You know, I don't live in rural Kenya, so I'm not going to tell people there how they should live their lives. But I can use my skills and my abilities and my training and my experiences to work together collaboratively to build their capacity and sustainability. And I think that's where we need to go. Yeah. Well, I can tell you with our work that I just presented the, you know, kind of the research part. We've been working with youth in this community to develop a range of interventions. So we have some of the young men started a group. I worked with them collaboratively to start a group called AMCA, which in Kiswahili means to rise up. It also stood for Awakening Men for Knowledge and Action, where we used information from this and from the youth to actually design a day-long young men's empowerment and risk reduction intervention that's been continuing on now without us there. They also did a youth testing day that just occurred this summer, and then we have our second youth testing day that's going to occur when we're going back in early December. And so what we've been doing, because a lot of the work we're doing is really grassroots, and so we've been feeding this information back into the community and working with young people and with the leaders in the community as well to use this information to develop different types of interventions.
That's a good question. Not just my work, but before my work, many other people have tried to assess what were the behavior changes that took place in Uganda and brought HIV down, and what were the other changes that took place. And in part because of those studies and also other evidence elsewhere, there is now a much greater recognition that reducing the number of sexual partners and reducing in particular concurrency, if you think about partners, they can either be sequential or they can be concurrent, and I alluded to this only very briefly. Concurrent means that they are overlapping. You have sex with one person, another, and then you go back the first, and then a third, and then maybe back the second. That HIV can be transmitted very, very rapidly, and this clearly happened in Kampala and other places in Uganda. When you have concurrent sexual partners, you become infected during the first few weeks. When you have a high viral load, you pass it on to the next person, etc. And so my studies that took place prior to mine and others are leading to a much greater recognition that whereas a lot of focus has been on abstaining or using condoms, that in fact reducing the number of partners and reducing concurrent sexual partners is extremely important in generalized epidemics as opposed to concentrated epidemics where it's limited, where HIV is limited to particular high-risk groups. Sex workers, for example, there you do need to use condoms, of course. But the B component, the reducing the number of partners, the being faithful, had been neglected. And I think there's an increasing recognition internationally that it is a very, very important behavior to change. Sure. I studied the period about 1986 up to 1995, and a lot has happened in Uganda since 1995, and I don't want to pretend to be particularly knowledgeable or an expert on that, because I've heard many, many conflicting stories about what has happened since 1995, and I really don't know which ones are true and which are not. Clearly, I think there has been a shift in messages. I mentioned initially there was primarily an emphasis upon being faithful, zero grazing, et cetera. It then shifted to condoms. And I think probably the emphasis upon condoms did continue for a while without much emphasis on being faithful, but then abstinence came in. And so you had then the condoms and the abstinence going on. And exactly how much on each, I really don't know. I've heard very conflicting stories. Other things have happened in Uganda as well. There's been a lot of fatigue. They're really tired of this issue. And there's also the availability of ARVs, antiretroviral drugs, which then diminish the cost. It, you know, reduces the probability of death. So some people are engaging in more risky behavior because of the availability of ARVs. Prevalence goes down only when people die. So in a very important way, the entire decline in prevalence is due to people dying. Of all the people that have died in Uganda, I think a very small percentage have actually died in the northern part where the war is taking place. You have areas in, you know, Rakai, Masaka, and so forth, which are much further south, way away from that. And most of the country, the prevalence has gone down. It's not gone down just in that one area, but really, it's been more than halved countrywide. So it's much, much more than just that one area. In fact, in that one area, because of all the chaos of the war, prevalence may not have gone down as much as in some of the other areas.
Thank you.